Okay, thanks very much for the opportunity to speak. I will talk about two effective theories, one about inflation and one about the long-distance universe. So let me start with the effective theory of inflation and its most important application, which is non-Gaussianities. So since I'm the first person mentioning Hubble in this conference, let me remind that cosmology, there are many experiments going on. And it's living a period of changing level. The quality of the experiment is changing now. And this is asking new questions. So Planck is in the orbit. Then there is many other experiments in South Pole, Hubble, Sloan. Many new experiments which are making us possible a new thing. That is, so far in cosmology, we're always concentrated on the linear theory, on the linear approximation to the equation of motion, which is equivalent to the free theory. Instead, now we are beginning to be sensitive to the interactions and therefore to the non-Gaussianities. And this is where effective theory really has a room to be applied, because it's really, effective theory is really important when you talk about interactions. It treats very well the interactions. And this should allow us, and this is really necessary, not only because this allows us to explore new physics beyond the standard model, but also it's really required to gain control of current and planned experiments. So it's a bit what particle physics was in the 80s now for cosmology. Indeed, let's take a look at inflation. How do we probe inflation? If you take the standard models of inflation, where it's low rolling scalar field, simply rolling down, and you look at the beautiful plot of the WMAP data, there are all these data points fitting this beautiful curve. But actually, at a real quantity level, this curve is fitted just by two numbers from inflation, which is the amplitude of the power spectrum, which is h over m Planck square, where h is the Hubble expansion during inflation, and epsilon is the role parameter. And the tilt, how much this number depends slightly on scale. So this plot, really, it's a fantastic measurement of the cosmological parameters so far, of what the universe is made. What the stuff making the universe? Hubble, omega baryon, omega dark matter, and most importantly, the dark energy, which got the Nobel Prize this year. They're all measured extremely very well. But what does this teach about inflation? So this picture teaches about inflation, a beautiful qualitative picture. The fact that there are sinusoidal fluctuations is a simple consequence of the fact that there were perturbations on super Hubble scale at the time of recombination, which means that the horizon was bigger than Hubble at horizon at recombination, and perturbations were longer than Hubble at recombination. But at the quantitative level, about inflation, we're just learning two numbers, the amplitude of the power spectrum and the tilt. And this is clearly a pity, because given so many data, beautifully so well this curve, it's clearly a loss to have just to fit two numbers about inflation. Indeed, the reason why we look at the two-point function is because we think that the distribution of the perturbation is a Gaussian. And therefore, for example, each Fourier mode follows this distribution. And in that case, the all information is in the two-point function, which is this function here, what is plotted here. And this comes from the fact that if you solve the equation for the quantum scalar field, each Fourier mode follows a linear equation to linear approximation. And if you replace, remember that this is an operator, this is the equation of motion for a harmonic oscillator, its vacuum state is a Gaussian. And that's why if you neglect interactions, you see only a Gaussian, you see only two-point functions. But clearly, the world didn't need to be like that. For example, there could be non-Gaussianities. For example, this is a non-Gaussian distribution. Indeed, there are infinite ways to be non-Gaussian. And this would come out if, for example, the scalar field didn't solve a linear equation, but a non-linear equation, like this one. So it tells us that if the distribution that comes from here and therefore is non-Gaussian, you have a new signal, which is really directly connected to interactions which are non-Gaussianities. And this means that this opens the doors to this kind of signature, like three-point function, in the cosmological perturbation, which can actually be detected. Indeed, the current limits are about the skewness of the distribution of non-Gaussianities is about 10 to the minus 2, which is scales more or less like the number of independent pixels or WMAP to the 1/2. And just to get an idea how good this cosmology data now, these are two, one Gaussian, one non-Gaussian, where the skewness is order 1. And okay, we are able to distinguish these two curves at 1% level in cosmology now. So this tells us that there is power in cosmological data now to explore the interacting field theory, not just the free theory. And these are very interesting interactions. This is interaction of physics beyond the standard model. This is inflation, maybe something at gas scale. It's something incredible that we have no idea what's going on there and how really to probe it alternatively than inflation. So can we have a large non-Gaussianities from inflation? Planck is a factor of 6 and 7 improvement with respect to the map.
In the 3.
Yeah, give or take factor of 2. And now, in order to do this, again, we're trying to explore interaction. So we thought to apply to cosmology the paradigm of effective field theory, which has been the guiding principle in particle physics for 30 years or so. And we thought it hadn't been applied in its power to inflation. So how do you construct the effective field theory of inflation? In order to do that, you have to think of inflation in the most essential way, which is to think that inflation is a quasi de Sitter. The only thing we know about inflation is that it's a quasi de Sitter phase that has two ends. This means that there is a physical clock measuring time, and the time translation are broken because this physical clock tells at some point inflation end. This means that there is a privileged spatial slicing during the de Sitter phase, where this physical clock, whatever it is, it's a constant. For example, we not assume that it's a scalar field, but if inflation was driven by a scalar field, something that I'm not assuming, but this would correspond to the gauge delta phi equal to 0, the fixed in time diffeomorphism. Now, once you're in this coordinate frame, you write down, you follow the rules of effective field theory, which means you have the degrees of freedom, which is just metric fluctuation in gauge, and in this gauge, and just you write down all the operator compatible with the symmetries, which are just time-dependent spatial diffeomorphisms, because you can change coordinates, spatial coordinates independent in each slice. And so what you can write are generic function of time, tensor with a zero index up, or geometric objects we build with these slices like the Strinsic curvature or the slices. So it can be proved. And then what you do is that you tell your expanding fluctuation according to how many legs you want to see of the process. And also you do derivative expansion, very much like in effective theory. And you can prove that the effective theory has always has this unique form. This is the Einstein-Liebert term. This is a term that's Stalinian fluctuation, a term which Stalinian fluctuations. These two terms have coefficient fixed by the symmetry of the property of the background, that is H, H dot, fix these two coefficients in such a way that the tadpole, that because these are two terms that are Stalinian fluctuation, this is linear because of square root of G, and they cancel the tadpole that you get if you expand the Einstein-Liebert around FRW. And that terms start quadratic in the fluctuation with a known coefficient, which depends on the high energy physics and the higher derivative term. So, okay, so this is it. This is the effective theory of inflation. Any inflationary model follows this Lagrangian. There is no exclusion. Actually, even we found models that were not discovered. We basically found all models of inflation. But clearly, this Lagrangian is not very simple to interpret. And it's not very simple to tap it because it's the Lagrangian of a spontaneously broken gauge symmetry. The gauge symmetry with spontaneously broken is time translation indeed. And we know that because of the Gostone boson equivalence theorem that it simplifies very much the physics if one introduces the Gostone boson, because this is the degrees of freedom that decouple in the high energy limit and the one which is strongly interacting in the energy physics. So in order to, so we reintroduce the Gostone boson, that is we reintroduce gauge, yes? Yeah, they're not invariant, so they enter in K, in the Strinsic curvature. So they enter, we're not invariant just on the spatial diffeomorphism and the time-dependent spatial diffeomorphism. So G0i enters the Strinsic curvature, which is dj G0i minus the symmetric. They enter, but only, they cannot enter alone, separate. They must.
Part of the gauge invariant.
Yeah, and the gauge invariant is the Strinsic curvature. The Strinsic curvature. Or the Riemann, I mean.
So,
yes.
Maybe you'll say something about the ground state. What vacuum you're going to choose?
Yeah, the vacuum would be the vacuum is the region where the Gostone boson has no gradients. Okay, so.
And so the ground state depends on the time slicing, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, there's always these issues about what the, when you calculate correlation functions, which you'll eventually do.
Yes, but we go for the, I don't see this effect, sorry, I mean, maybe I'm confused, because when you compute correlation function here, we do the uniformities, and we post to be in the vacuum, and if we pass.
Yeah, but what vacuum?
And the vacuum is
the sitter is in the vacuum.
Yeah, usually the sitter back.
Not Bunch Davies or the
sitter. Ah, Bunch Davies. Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. I'll take Bunch Davies. Yeah. The fluctuation will go to the Bunch Davies vacuum in the past.
Meaning,
at very short distances, you recover mid Kozki back. At very short distances, you recover mid Kozki. But is that the one? Is that consistent with the sitter symmetry?
Well, in the initial condition, that tells you that at the initial time in inflation, first of all, like, this is not the sitter invariant. We're not in the sitter space. We are in inflation, which translations are broken. So, but it's just telling you that in initial times, you don't start with these very excited modes, which have infinite energy. So, you don't excite them. You are in the vacuum. So, every time the epidemic wavelength is way inside the horizon, mm-hmm. and you impose it to be not be excited in the vacuum of the
it's not necessary to consider also the dynamics of the analytics which gives the equation.
Well, the only thing we see of inflation are the fluctuations of this degree of freedom. There is nothing else. So this reproduces all what you observe. And actually, this is the theory you're being tested. It's really like for the the analogy is really strict to the Pani Lagrange. You could say, oh, but you shouldn't I discuss the chiral sector that's condensed and scary chiral symmetry. You can, it's more complete description, but you can do a lot of physics without. Yeah. You need the point of the Gostung boson is that you don't need to describe the background, how it runs. You're in the vacuum of the Gostung boson. So, in order to reduce the Gostung boson, you perform something that is called the Stukuber trick. That is, you perform a diffeomorphism, the one which is broken, which is 10 translation, and doesn't lead the Lagrangian invariant. For example, G00 goes into this combination. And you promote this diffeomorphism that you call pi, a tiny diffeomorphism that you call pi, to be a field, such that it translates it shifts under 10 translation, which tells you that this is indeed the Gostung boson. And now you have introduced one gauge freedom, and you introduce the Gostung boson. But the usual thing, the useful thing of the Gostung boson is that in the high energy limit, it decouples from the metric fluctuation, and the field becomes first decoupled and then strongly interacting. And this means that you can go to high energy and neglect in the energy limit and neglect all the mixing with gravity, which is all the metric fluctuations. Now, the reason why you can do this in inflation is because inflation is probing the theory at energy scales over the Hubble. In order to make prediction for inflation, you need to compute the correlation function when the mode has energy over the Hubble. And from then on, all the modes during all the remaining evolution of the universe, when the mode becomes very infrared, the amplitude is constant. So your inflation is really probing the theory at energy scales over the Hubble, which means that if this energy can be a pretty high energy scale, and if this energy scale is above the scale at which mixing with gravity becomes irrelevant, then you can just neglect the mixing with gravity. This is the analogous to the Gostung boson equivalence theorem, for example, for the W bosons, where at energy scale over the MW, you can neglect, you can consider the longitudinal polarization of the W boson to be completely decoupled from the spin-1 component of the Vertov boson. And the theory, you have just a theory of a scalar. So we do the same for inflation, and this is the result. So, which is pretty simple, given that it contains all possible models of inflation. For example, this is the pi, you should think as a scalar field, is the Gostung boson. It has a standard kinetic term, which is not standard with some interactions, term with stable interactions, and so on. And this is very analogous construction to the chiral Lagrangian. It's the action for the Gostung boson. This is telling you that inflation is really what we are really probing is the theory. It's not tied to B string or some UV completion. It's really the theory of this Gostung boson. And indeed, it unifies all possible single field models in one unique framework. And in particular, it allows you to prove theorems. For example, just for the sake of stating, you can prove the following theorem, that in single clock models, when there is only one relevant degree of freedom, inflation is the only mechanism, is the only history of the universe that can give you more than 10 foldings of scale invariant perturbation without the theorem being strongly coupled, that is, we being under control. So it doesn't matter the details of the theorem, but the fact that there are theorems on the signal that you can prove, I think it's very powerful. And this is because you have access to all information. Also, since you use effective theories in the most essential way, you see what is forced by the symmetries and what is not. For example, you can see that the kinetic term has a coefficient to be fixed by m plus square h dot, while the time kinetic term can be changed by this factor. Indeed, this is the wrong sign for h dot until you, for h dot positive, which is the null generation case. And this is how we found for the first time how to violate the energy condition, because higher derivative terms can become important. Then, but you see that instead the coefficient of pi dot square can be different from the one of the I pi square, which means that the speed of sound or the fluctuation can be different. Indeed, the theory is not relativistic. Time translation Lorentz is broken. So speed of sound equal to one wasn't protected by any sense. And indeed, can be order one violated. But notice that by nonlinear realization of time diffeomorphisms, whenever you have pi dot square, not in this combination, you must have self-interactions. And they are fixed by the symmetries. They cannot be removed. In particular, this one cannot be removed. Which tells you that since interactions means non-Gaussianities, this means that if you want the speed of sound small, you make this operator large, which means that self-interaction large, and means that the non-Gaussianities goes like 1 over the speed of sound square, which means that if you measure some specific shape of non-Gaussianities, you measure the speed of sound and the fluctuations, and you measure this interactive operator, and this is a theorem, it just comes from the symmetries. Even more importantly, I think, it shows that there are some self-interaction of the Gostone boson that can be large without spoiling the theory. This theory is technically natural in the sense that it's made only of irrelevant operator. There is nothing if you make this operator large, it's not spoiling the theory, it's making the theory in tuned. So it's all marginal operator, it's technically natural, which means that this operator can be large without spoiling the theory, and this means that there are some interaction that can be large, and therefore large non-Gaussianities can be generated. So this is a change of picture with respect to the first 20 years of inflation, where we were told that inflation predicts completely Gaussian fluctuation. I believe this was our incomplete knowledge of inflation. We find that there are models that can predict large non-Gaussianities, and from the effective theory point of view, they are completely, they are order one, even order one fraction of the parameter space. And this tells us that there is a theoretical motivation for look for the frequent function. And if you look for the frequent function, a paradise for theoretical physics open up. Because while the two-point function is so much restricted by the symmetries, that the De Sitter symmetries force is so much, actually so powerful in the two-point function that is left only two numbers, the scale invariance, so the amplitude of the power spectrum, and the slight deviation for scale invariant, which is the tilt, just two numbers. The same symmetry on the frequent function are much less powerful and leave out much more freedom. So for example, the frequent function in Fourier space of the density fluctuation must form a closed triangle in Fourier space. The free momentum must form a closed triangle because of momentum conservation. But so the free sides must form a triangle. And once you use all the symmetries, you can notice that the free function is only a function of the shape of this triangle. So you can fix a side and you can move this vertex everywhere on a plane. And this leaves a full function of two variables, it's a function of shape. For example, this is the squash shape. This point is the equilateral shape. This point here is the squeezed triangle shape. And you see that there are very, very interesting shapes. Indeed, this is the same information as a scattering amplitude of particle physics as a function of angles. Indeed, it's the same process. So this means that you could observe scattering amplitude in the sky. And you see that there are limits, infinite points. These are infinite points, these are functions. And there are two operators, the leading order derivative. So you see that there is a whole family of shapes on non-Gaussianities. Remember that if you measure these, not only these are such non-trivial signal that you're sure that inflation is there, because while the scale invariant power spectrum was predicted before inflation, it was called Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum, nobody could predict this function. These functions are so non-trivial that are really a signature of inflation. But also, thanks to the fact that now you have an universal Lagrangian for inflation, you can map whatever you observe in the sky, not in some cosmological parameter like omega dark matter, omega baryon. You map it into parameters of a Lagrangian. Like, for example, limits on non-Gaussianities are limits, or detection on Gaussianity, are measurements of these coefficients of the Lagrangian, that here I simply relabeled, which can be, which are really this number, the measurement of this parameter. And you can draw counter plots, for example, of our knowledge of inflation, and counter plots of the exclusion or the allowed region for this parameter, the 1, 2, 3 sigma. So this is really achieving, I think, the qualitative improvement of translating cosmological observation directly into particle physics, fundamental physics knowledge, because we want to know the Lagrangian, and this is really giving you the direct mapping to the Lagrangian. Indeed, this is what is called precision. In particle physics, they do this all the time. It's called precision electroweak tests. And now we can do, if you want, the precision electroweak test analogous for inflation, and filling the gap between observation and cosmological observation. And there is a family of plots because there are various phenomenological regimes. So you can really, in this way, you really connect fully to particle physics, and you're able to use the same, actually use the same techniques that particle physics used, and you can connect directly to fundamental physics, which is really, I think, what many of us want from cosmology, is really an understanding about fundamental physics.
C tilde 3 is 0.
Oh, no, that's, it is a 2 sigma. So indeed, there is a 2 sigma. I won't give you the data, but there is a 2 sigma. Right, it's in the sigma region.
But that's 0. I'm sorry, I didn't read that.
But it's there is a 2 sigma anomaly. So now that you have a Lagrangian, you can apply the phenomenological studies with Lagrangian, and for example, ask what are all the possible kind of non-Gaussians you can have. Indeed, non-Gaussianity is such a complex signal. Have you seen the shapes? That in the data analysis, if you don't look for it, you're not going to get it. That is, it's possible to, for example, with the affected theory, we found one shape on non-Gaussianities already, which was part of this plot, that could have been 10 sigma in the data, WMAP data, but nobody looked for it because nobody had predicted it. And so there was no limits, basically no limits on that. And then we did analysis, we found 2 sigma effect. So if you look for new shapes, you can it's very easy to find shapes that are all completely orthogonal to already made survey. Because this is such a non-trivial signal that unless you look specifically for it, you're not going to see it. So it's worth to, and since this is the full Lagrangian of inflation, you can go and study the full phenomenology. So there is a sort of program to study, for example, all the phenomenology of this Lagrangian. And for example, you apply really what you have learned in particle physics, you can apply here. For example, you can impose additional symmetries on this Gostown bosons. So for example, you can study the case in which there is a discrete Schiss symmetry. So this Gostown boson is naturally endowed with a continuous Schiss symmetry that you can softly break to a discrete Schiss symmetry. Indeed, this is the effective theory of where you're saying of models that really came out, inspired from string theory, which are, for example, axiom modonodromy, which have the beautiful feature that can predict oscillation in the power spectrum, very rapid oscillation in the power spectrum, but also predicted oscillating non-Gaussianities, whose shape was very remarkable like this one. So the question that was in the literature when we decided to study this case was, is possible that this non-Gaussian signal could be larger, could have more signal than the oscillation in the two-point function? And the answer, depending on how you look at the literature, you could think so. And in effect, the theory is very simple to see that this is impossible, so that these non-Gaussianities can only be a very subleading effect. And so in some strict sense, they don't exist. That is, will be detected only after you have detected very well them in the power spectrum, some oscillation in the power spectrum. And in effect, the theory is very simple, because oscillation, this discrete symmetry, forces the potential for the Gostown boson to, since pi is the Gostown boson time translation must come in a combination t plus pi. So there is a potential term like cos of omega background times t plus pi. And once you canonically normalize, you find there is a pi canonical over lambda. Sorry, here I made a typo. This omega b should be inside lambda. But this tells that once you canonically normalize the field, the lambda is really the cutoff. So you get the cos, this should have been cos of t. cos of omega t omega background t plus pi canonical over lambda. And this tells you that lambda is the cutoff scale of the theory, is the unitarity bound of the theory. And what happens is that by the nonlinear realization of time diffeomorphism, this term must be accompanied by the T. So when modes begin inside the horizon and begin to redshift, they see this oscillation. And there is a time in which their frequency is of order the background frequency, and they go into resonance. And this leaves an imprint in their modes, in their wave function. And this, since it is a resonance effect, is non-Gaussian. And the size of the non-Gaussianity, you can estimate like saying that is the ratio, which is the skewness of the parameter, which is the amount of non-Gaussianity, for example, in the endpoint function, are dimensionalized in the sense of skewness to the two-point function to the n over 2, scales like the n-order interaction Lagrangian that you get from Taylor expanding this quantity over the quadratic Lagrangian. That is, yes?
You said that the non-Gaussianity could be hiding in the data.
But yes.
My understanding is that we can look at the data and see whether it's Gaussian or not. And
yeah.
Isn't it true that so far there is no non-Gaussianity?
So far there is no non-Gaussianity, but which non-Gaussianity do you look for? Because the non-Gaussianity is not unique.
You look if it looks like a veil or not.
Yeah, okay, that's a very, so this is a particular estimator for all the non-Gaussianities. And it's incredibly very suboptimal for many non-Gaussianities, for most of them. I mean, it's very non-specific search for non-Gaussianities. That is, it tells you something, but you can improve by factor of 20 easily if you do that analysis. Factor of 20 in that analysis is 20 sigma detection.
Okay.
Yeah, just.
And the second question, your analysis seems to be limited to scalar modes. Is that correct? You're not considering vector modes and the tensor modes in the perturbations of cosmology?
So, I don't know if you, so you could insert vector modes and tensor modes in the effective theory of inflation, and this is something we are doing. It's a slow process. This is now this thing is picking up, but there was very little people working on this until recently. So you can put them. Vector modes is very difficult to put because they're conformally coupled, so they don't usually do anything during inflation. But then you could, your question might instead of being asked, do you put the cosmological vector modes or tensor modes at the time of CMB? Maybe sourced by, for example, gravitational waves produce polarization. Okay, those are very small so far, and there is not much information added by them. People is using, when you do the analysis, you use the polarization signal. The E modes polarization is being used, but tensor mode, there is no detection, so of E modes.
So your answer is that you're working on it, but it's not important?
Sorry. We're trying to explore that. The effective inflation, you could couple these two, as I mentioned, multi-field, you could couple it to scala, to tensor modes, to see what they do, maybe coupling back to the ineffective theory during inflation. Then later on, so maybe they affect the perturbation theory of the spy by some coupling. Then when they decouple, when inflation ends, then vector modes during the history of the universe decay. So they're very small. And tensor modes don't decay. They decay inside the horizon, but they could be detectable, but this is not detected anymore. Yeah.
Maybe you can also say, it's not making any assumption about what's driving inflation. And you still have this, it's not really scalar, right, because you work in tensor stations, but this is the full set of one plot model, right? No matter what's driving inflation. No matter if it's a scalar field, a vector field, whatever.
It looks like a scalar.
Well, it's a scalar, exactly,
yes.
but it's the perturbation of whatever is the clock is doing, and the clock you don't know.
You don't know.
You have a
zero
for the
back,
two fields. You have
so there is an inflation, there is at least this field. This field must be there. It's the field that drives inflation, whatever it is, fundamentally. But then you can couple to additional fields. I will mention it. So coming back to the non-Gaussianities, the amount of non-Gaussianities is the ratio of the endpoint function over the two-point function, which is really the ratio of the interacting Lagrangian over the quadratic Lagrangian evaluated at the resonance frequency, which is pretty high energy. We go like omega resonance. So it goes like, if you Taylor expand, it goes as pi canonical over lambda, so goes omega resonance over lambda to the n, which tells you that within the regime of validity of the effective theory, once you're not strongly coupled, you must have omega resonance much smaller than lambda and higher endpoint function, low smaller than the two-point function, which means that the leading signal is always going to be the two-point function.
And this is really very easy, straightforward to see. You already see in the within effective theory. But before the introduction of this effective theory, it was very complicated to see. And indeed, if you know the literature, there was some complication here. Another thing you can ask, now that you have, again, the general Lagrangian reflection, you can ask, what are all the possible leading operators that you can have? And indeed, one could ask, is it possible to have higher derivative operators to be the leading ones? And the answer, this is something in progress, but we believe it's yes, because we're able to identify new symmetries, new field theory symmetries. For example, take a scalar field in Minkowski space and perform this generalized shift. You can easily realize that the kinetic term is invariant if you are substitute here, if this tensor is traceless. If you take a generic term, I mean, you should sum over all, in order to commute with translation, you should really put tensors of all the indices. But if all these tensors are traceless, the kinetic term is invariant. But the interaction term, not. And then the interaction term will be a very, very higher derivative term. So this tells you that there are technically natural field theories where the leading interaction comes a very higher order in derivatives. And I think this is a quite interesting field theory statement that nobody told me it was known. So now you can apply this symmetry to inflation, to the effective theory of inflation, impose this kind of symmetry on the Goldstone boson. And you can find that any arbitrary high number of derivative operator can be the leading interacting operator. So this effective theory can start interacting a very, very high energy derivative operators. And this means that the leading operator can be extremely irrelevant. And the question would be where to stop. And what you see is that if the leading operator is a very, very high derivative operator, then the amount of non-Gaussianity, the skewness, which we call FNN zeta, goes like, since the non-Gaussianities are basically evaluated in the interaction of Hamiltonian and energies of order Hubble, then it goes, this operator goes like, the size of this operator goes like h over lambda to some dimension connected to the dimension of the operator. And for this to be negligible, for this to be measurable, lambda, as you increase n, must be closer and closer to Hub, to h. And this means that you're pushing the cutoff lower, in order to have a detectable signal, you're pushing the cutoff lower and lower, closer to Hubble, because you're making the theory, you want the signal coming from a very relevant operator to be detectable. And so this offers you a way to stop, because at some point, the effective theory still closes, because at some point, the cutoff gets too close to Hubble. And then we perform a study, and we find that indeed that there is a new shape of non-Gaussianity that wasn't found before, which happens at the leading operator to be a nine derivative operator, which is this one. For example, this one is completely orthogonal to all the shapes that have been analyzed so far, and it could be 20 sigma in the data, for example. So now we are planning to look for in the data. So this is a part of the phenomenology process of studying the phenomenology of the effective theory of inflation.
So you're saying that there is a new shape if you include nine derivatives? Is that the
yeah.
Okay, so if I include 10 derivatives, will it be another new shape? Or?
Yeah, it's very, yeah, in fact, so as we said, we stop at nine derivatives because then the cutoff becomes uncomfortably close to Hubble. So the only reason to stop is this reason. And then it's quite remarkable that since we're looking only to level amplitudes, if you go up to eight derivatives, there is nothing new. So all the shapes look like, you see, this is symmetry that I just highlighted allows you to have an effective theory which starts at 7 derivatives, 6 derivatives. And, but there is no new shape. So the signal, it's always on this form. Well described by these two.
But is this much smaller than those two other ones?
No, because if you impose these symmetries, the leading derivative operator are zero or highly suppressed. So you have a theory which is like d pi square plus dn pi cube, for example, with some lambda here, some number. So this is the theory. The coefficient of pi dot cube is it's highly suppressed in such a way that this effect is more linear with respect to this.
What is the symmetry at suppressed?
And this symmetry here that I just discussed. 5 goes into 5 plus this kind of shift. which as far as I know is a new symmetry. I mean, okay. I think this is interesting because really we know inflation is there, and this is the unique Lagrangian. It's worth to study what it is, and these data are already there, available for us. So it's quite pointless not to exploit them. Indeed, as we mentioned, this was the theory of the degree of freedom that needs to be there. Indeed, it's the Gaussian boson. It must be there by definition of inflation because inflation ends, then translation are broken. But of course, there are the models where there is multiple fields. So we try to describe in effective field theory language the multi-field inflation case. So there must be that one, but nobody forbids to have additional fields. Indeed, people have studied for a long time multiple fields. I mean, it's not, I think in inflation we don't choose much ingredients. I mean, maybe you're asking, there is no necessity to have multiple fields.
Yeah.
Yes, no, I agree with you. There is no necessity, but nothing forbids. For example, they can, for example, if you have supersymmetry, you must have another field, which is the, for example, if you have a current multiple, the scalar field is a complex, so there is a companion.
No, I was just wondering whether in your context there was some particular reason.
I think the idea is to apply, well, no, it's not motivated, but it could be there. For example, there are many, many models of inflation. You can very easily look up a model of inflation where there is a second field that controls, for example, the time at which inflation ends. For example, it's taking a second field whose fluctuations control the decay rate of the inflow at the end of inflation. So the fluctuation of this field will affect the decay rate of the inflaton, and therefore will affect the duration of inflation, the much universe span in each location, and will introduce curvature perturbation. So since we have experiments already done, we want to explore the full possibilities of inflation, and we want to cover it. Indeed, this is frankly the only chance we have to see 10 to the 16 GV. So how do you couple additional degrees of freedom to the effective theory of inflation? Well, what you do is simply you go again to the unitary gauge where pi was set to zero, and couple, and then you declare to have additional degrees of freedom, for example, a master scalar field. And indeed, we know that master scalar fields are difficult to get, so there must be Gaussian boson, either of time translation, or either of some abelian or abelian group, or must be protected by supersymmetry. So we need all this case. For example, for the abelian case, this is the Lagrangian. You again write all the possible coupling to the Gaussian boson compatible with time-dependent diffeomorphism. For example, you can write a coupling like G0 mu d mu phi. And then you study the perturbations. So this is the physics. If this sigma field, as I mentioned, if this second field affects the duration of inflation, then this sigma field converts into curvature perturbation, the fluctuation converts into curvature perturbation, and this is an observable field. Another possibility is for this field to back react on pi, and this is what we did very generally with Raphael. And if the only effect of this sigma field is to back react on pi and affect the pi fluctuation, the field that really needs to be there, you will have some effective dissipation for the pi Gaussian boson, and this Raphael will talk about this. So instead here, I will just mention this effective theory when we see the additional field, so we have to describe very concretely its Lagrangian. We cannot integrate out. And you see that there are very, very peculiar symmetry effects. For example, the additional fields can have a speed of sound different from one. Or for example, they can mix, there can be a linear mixing with the Gaussian boson, but can only be at time level. There cannot be a special kinetic mixing. And this is, for example, a powerful statement coming just from the symmetries. So let me just go through, because it's very easy for these Gaussian additional fields, which are ordinary, let's say Gaussian boson, to be self-interacting, like the pions of particle physics. And a very interesting signal that emerged is that it's very easy for this field to have a large four-point function, no three-point function. And for example, again, the four-point function could be in the data. Nobody has analyzed the four-point function in the data, or very little has been done. It could be again, 50 sigma in the data. Because four-point function has been looked only in an approximate way. And so, for example, you can impose, for example, that this Gaussian boson have a sigma minus sigma symmetry. Or, for example, you can impose that there is the Lagrangian, the Gaussian boson is very Lorentz invariant.
And then you have all these quartic interactions that can become very relevant. So and while this tells us, and it's the first time, they tell us that the four-point function can be very large, can be highly produced by inflation without having an even stronger three-point function. And the four-point function is a function of five variables, so it's even larger than the two-point function. It's even larger than the three-point function in terms of signal, so it's incredibly rich, an incredibly rich amount of signal that if we see it, it would be just fantastic. Okay, there is, you can see that, for example, if this additional goes, both are non-abelian, then the anti-symmetry of the structure cost are priced at a very interesting law. And for example, you can have correlation of four-point function between a purely Gaussian statistic, purely adiabatic statistic and mixed adiabatic isocurvature statistic in the SMB, if you detect isocurvature fluctuation. And for example, the shape of the non-Gaussianities, which mapped one-to-one into operators of Lagrangian, would be so peculiar that, for example, we declare that it would be a signature of, you could detect, for example, you can make the statement that there were non-abelian Gaussian boson during inflation and controlling the duration of inflation. So this was just to give you a light. The phenomenology of multi-field inflation and also single-field inflation is very rich. For example, in multi-field, you can have a different speed of sound. We make the table. Here there is every operator. And which kind of dispersion ratio can come from, if it is come from the adiabatic or isocurvature fluctuation, if it is generated in the abelian and non-abelian case, if there is a squeeze limit, which is important for large structure formation. We highlighted this symmetry, which is Lorentz invariant symmetry or conformal symmetry. And depends on what you see, you can even tell them apart. You can detect multi-field inflation, exclude single-field inflation, and you can describe the nature of the symmetry protecting this additional scalar field. Because now, if you detect non-Gaussianity, you really have access to the interaction theory, and this is so non-trivial that you can read off the nature of the theory. So this is a field which is being used more and more. It's sort of a program that you can describe. Now we have the means to describe any possible inflation Lagrangian, even the one whose background, for example, is strongly coupled. And there are several projects going on, like higher drift interaction, additional massive fields. And indeed, people is beginning to work on this, not only people around me, collaborators on me, but also people in Princeton, Cambridge, CERN, San Diego. Indeed, there will be a workshop in Leiden that I am organizing, which is really on the effective theory of inflation. So it's even more narrow than this one. So. And you are welcome about that. And this is really being taught in graduate school at Stanford and Harvard by people. So it's becoming very, very well, beginning to be accepted by the community. Yeah, for example, these are operators that induce a four-point function because they're a quartic operator, with a very, very specific shape. This shape is a function of seven variables. So for example, this shape is very different from this one. So you can clearly detect it. And for example, you could detect both of these. One would be in a correlation with isocurvature fluctuation. So since they depend on many parameters, they're kind of orthogonal, you could see both. They don't cover each other. So first of all, if you see such a shape, it's so non-trivial that you say, okay, I detected this interaction. And then if you detect both, we notice that detecting both is very unusual because this is dimension 6 operator, this is dimension 8 operator. And it's possible to detect both only because because this guy goes into this curvature fluctuation, so it's suppressed. So you can have very, very rich signal, very much like the three-point function I highlighted before, very much like this one, but more complicated. These are two variables. This is a function of five variables. Like instead of 2-to-2 scattering, this is the same number of variables as the angular dependent of 2-to-2 scattering. The four-point function is like 2-to-3, 2-to-4. Okay, so it's kind of, so if you see that, you conclude that you see this interaction, and there's not much doubt about that, because it's very non-trivial. While the scale invariance of the two-point function, it's a tough. It's maybe it's enough, but it's a tough call. Did I answer your question? Did I answer?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is about it for the effective theory of inflation. I just wanted to, I think it's something that is going on and several people are working on it now.
Instead, now I want to talk about, in the second part of my talk, I would like to talk about a different application of effective theory to cosmology, which is the effective theory of the long distance universe. So this is a totally different setup. Now we'll go 13 million years forward in time and we go to our current universe. And this is the result of two papers, one with Alberto and now with somebody else, which we're currently doing now. So the question you want to ask is, if you look at the current universe now, you have short scale linearity, large scale linearities, and this clearly calls for an effective theory construction. I will construct it and we'll show some application. Indeed, let's look at our universe. Our universe is characterized by two scales. The scale at which there are inside Hubble, in which fluctuations are very, very, very mild, small amplitude fluctuation, and the scale which is called the nonlinear scale, about 10 or 100 megaparsecs, more 10, where cosmological perturbation has become nonlinear. So the theory of the universe is in a sense nonlinear, but this nonlinearity is very concentrated on a very specific scale. Indeed, if you take, for example, QCD below the phase transition, halo energy QCD is linear, what is linear is the pari Lagrangia, but in ultraviolet becomes strongly coupled, like QCD, and you have a quantum nonlinearity. Our universe is very similar, and very large distance. No, below the phase transition, the pions. The pions are.
I thought you said QCD is strongly coupled with UV.
Sorry?
Did you just say?
Yeah, let's not go to very high energy. Let's go to high energy, I mean 1 GV. Then it becomes QCD.
Okay.
I'm just talking about the Carolina.
Yeah,
thank you for this. Thank you. Now, instead, our universe is very similar. It's basically linear large scale, and in ultraviolet, it becomes classically strongly coupled, classically nonlinear. The linear scale, indeed, here it was 1 GV, here it is 10 megaparsec. But it's very similar, and so you can think in the same kind of terms. So, nonlinearity are considered on short scale, and instead, on very large scale, the universe is linear. And you can ask the question why the universe is really described in a FRW metric. The fact that on short scale the universe is very nonlinear does have some back reaction on the long mode? And more in general, what is the effective theory that describes the long distance dynamics? So the answer will be that the effect of the short modes on the long distance physics will be small, but will be important and in some sense measurement. But the effect is small, it will also be a bit tricky. Indeed, we will find that there is no large back reaction from the fact that the universe went nonlinear on short scale on the dynamics of the universe on very large scales. This sounds a bit intuitive, but if you do the calculation, you find people used to find, and it's reasonable to find some large effect. And then there is a literature, there's a small community working on this. This was a very important challenge to the acceleration of the universe due to the cosmological constant. So it was good to theoretically clear. And the answer will be no. Another effect that we will mention is that, which is very important, is about the back. It really is very important to quantify the back reaction of the short modes on very long distance physics. This is so because the only reason why we believe in inflation, the prediction of inflation, is the fact that since the end of inflation, modes evolve constantly. They don't evolve anymore. They stay constant during the remaining epoch of the universe. Modes that are longer than the horizon. This is very important because in the meantime, there is baryogenesis, reheating. There is much physics that we have no idea what's going on. This is why even this Gostown boson was useful, because you just need to make prediction at the epoch of inflation and at energy scale over the Hubble inflation, and that's it. But if short-scale modes back react on long-distance physics and, for example, change the amplitude of a mode which is longer than the horizon, then the amplitude of the modes could change by order one. For example, reheating, the theory is very strongly coupled up to horizon scale, so this would change naively the amplitude of the long-distance modes by an order one, so we will lose predictivity of inflation. And indeed, when people do perturbative calculation, they find some effect in this direction, which are very dangerous. We will find that once you redefine the background, you expand around the short distance physics modifies a bit the background, but once you redefine the background, expand around the correct background,
there is no effect. And finally, the most important application, which is really my main, personally to me the main motivation, is to define a well-defined perturbation theory for galaxy surveys. That is, the cosmological experiments are moving towards large gas structure surveys, which is basically catalog galaxies and constructing the density field of galaxies everywhere. These fields contain the same information as the CMB. It's just the time evolves the CMB to the present time. In order to recover the cosmological information, for example, about inflation, about dark energy, from this galaxy survey, you need to reconstruct the primordial density fields. Now, or in other words, from the primordial density field, you have to be able to reproduce what we see in the sky. Now, the people try to do this analytically and find, for example, that if numerical simulation predicts this curve, analytical calculations are off by an order one number. And this is something called baryon acoustic oscillation, which is, for example, the best probe we have for the cosmic acceleration. And clearly, there is a problem. We're going to probe this curve. We're going to probe this curve at 1% level. And clearly, we cannot stand with such a problem. And this is this is very disappointing because this scale here is 100 megaparsec, which is inside the linear regime. So perturbation at 100 megaparsec, delta rho over rho is about 10 to the minus 2. So it should be treatable. And it's disappointing that it's non-treatable. The reason why it's non-treatable is because when you do nonlinear perturbation theory, there are convolution loops. And these loops go into the ultraviolet, where delta rho over rho, for example, here on very small distances, which is here, the delta rho over rho is very large, and this affects the calculation. So people have done something to improve it, but it's fair to say, I think there hasn't been a systematic treatment. And this is clearly disappointing because we are in the perturbative regime. It's like having the pi Lagrangian at 200 MeV and not being able to do perturbation theory. Indeed, people, in order to compensate for the deficit, the deficiency of the analytical prediction to the full result, they put some, they say that the observed power spectrum, this is the power spectrum, is the linear evolved times a damped term, and then some stochastic part. This is very phenomenological, maybe with some intuitive physical intuition, but we'll derive an effective theory which exactly matches these properties. That is, we will basically conventional perturbation theory applies expanding delta rho over rho and study the theory basically at all frequency, at all momenta. Instead, here we will define very simply an effective theory with some cutoff, and we'll define the effective theory at energy scale below this cutoff, which will be an effective theory which is different from the one you started with. We will see that this effective theory of a fluid, a very imperfect fluid, with also stochastic effects, but where all the quantities like delta rho over rho, the velocity phi, will be much less than one, and so will be manifestly convergent. So let's start to construct this effective theory of the long distance universe. Again, the simplest way to construct it, which is the way we constructed, is the fact that to exploit the fact that there's a huge hierarchy of scale between the scale where we're interested, which is around Hubble scale, and the scale where physics becomes nonlinear. On large scale, perturbations are small, but it's also the regime where you're very relativistic. So you have to be careful about gauge invariants. The scaling of the operator, for example, is delta rho over rho is over the delta b and is over the phi. This is a very very relativistic scale. Gauge transformations are very important. But these apply on scales of order Hubble. Instead of smooth scales, the theory becomes very non-relativistic. It becomes non-linear, but also very non-relativistic. And there is another approximation that emerges that you know very well, which is the Newtonian approximation, where the operator scales non-linearly. Phi goes like delta v square, and this scales much, much less than delta rho over rho. So now, this is trivial for all of you that do post-Newtonian approximation, but it wasn't trivial in the field of cosmology, also because you have to match two different scales and two different scalings. And in particular, people was questioning if this post-Newtonian Newtonian expansion is really gauge invariant. In some sense, it's not gauge invariant because you could choose always the frame where delta rho over rho is zero. You can choose the slicing where delta rho over rho is zero, and then you don't have, it's not true, this effect. And this is I think the reason why the Newton approximation merges at short distances is really again the Goston boson equivalence theorem, which is that there are particular gauges where the physics of delta rho over rho decouples from the physics of the metric and becomes strongly coupled. Indeed, you can really say it in terms of Goston boson because the presence of a non-trivial metal configuration breaks diffeomorphism, breaks the diffeomorphisms of gravity. And therefore, there is a Goston boson associated with that, and which is in the metal sector. And this is the field which becomes strongly coupled at short distance. It's not gravity that is becoming strongly coupled. So on short distance, we will just do the very simple Newton approximation. And we'll declare what we find from Newton approximation to source the long distance physics. So the strategy will be that we look at the short modes where where we'll be able to apply Newton approximation. So the way we can start is that matter moves in a flat space time, where and we'll define the stress energy tensor of the short scale matter, which is ordinarily conserved. Now, this stress energy tensor is what sources gravity on the long distance physics. And therefore, we will find this term nu in the Newton approximation and use GR concept. That is, we will say that this term nu, whether we find in Newton approximation, will source long distance physics. Okay, let me just highlight a bit the derivation. It's very useful to go to the Fermi coordinate frames. That is, we take an FRW universe, and you can do the following change of coordinates around the origin, such that the metric around the origin takes the following form. Which you can see is like eta mu nu is the FRW is the Minkowski metric times a correction that goes like h times x square. So this is really it's really a metric written in the Newtonian form where the FRW Newtonian potential is h times x square. And for example, the expansion of the universe is seen in this coordinate frames as all the particles having velocity, which goes like hx. In this coordinate frame, which is just come from the equivalence principle. It's important to see that this coordinate frame, this Quasi-Minkowski frame, holds for all times. This is not the Riemann normal coordinates, but the Fermi coordinates, because this frame is commoving, if you want, with a free-falling observer and lasts for an infinite amount of time. And this is important for us because while we are interested in distances much smaller than Hubble, we are interested for times of order Hubble. So we need a frame that lasts forever. And but in this frame does the job, and the Newtonian approximation is manifest at small distances. So the equation of motion for the short distance physics is very simple. For example, take a fluid which is just with dark matter. The equation of motion are just the Newtonian equation, trivial, Poisson, momentum, and energy conservation. And then it's possible to recast this equation in terms of the conservation of the timo nu. For example, if you choose to have the momenta to be very intuitively the rho times the velocity, then you can write the momentum equation just with some manipulation that I can skip as the derivative, the divergence of the I component, the mu tamu I, and where tau j takes the following form. There is rho matter times b square plus the tensor that comes from gravity. This tau j, which is this square, is very intuitive. The pressure, for example, tau j is the pressure. The pressure is the special part, so it has pressure. It's very intuitive that there is pressure associated with the velocity dispersion. And here there is a gravitational part, which is the pressure due to gravity. Similarly, the matter, the tau T00, the energy density, is the energy density plus the kinetic energy, the matter density plus the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. Let me just skip. So this tells us that this is the effective stress energy tensor that sources gravity at long distances. And then since we want the effective theory with just valid at long distances, we simply smooth it out, apply a smoothing filter to this field. Basically, we put a cutoff in Fourier space. And we define smoothed variable like smoothed density, smoothed phi, smoothed velocity. And you see that this field is quadratic. This tau j is quadratic in the fields, which means that there will be a long wavelength. Even though all the fields here are short distance fields, they will back react, they will couple they will produce a long wavelet fluctuation, which can be cast in this way. So there is a correction to the energy density and a correction to the pressure. So what we see from this construction is that short distance physics modifies the stress energy tensor of long distance physics, and there is a renormalization of the energy density and a renormalization of the pressure. Indeed, we started with zero pressure, and this is so pressure goes from being zero to non-zero. So the stress energy tensor of the long distance physics is different from the one of the short distance physics. And it is really trivial. I mean, you could have written down directly, in a very simple way, you could have written directly the momentum equation and smoothed it out with the field, defining the smoothed field in this way, with the filter. And you can recast this equation in the following way, where there is the standard momentum equation for the long distance physics equal the gradients of tau j coming from the short, where tau j coming from the short is this thing. So you see that this gradient acts really like the stress energy tensor, how a stress energy tensor would enter for the long distance physics, and tells us that the long distance physics gets a new contribution from this term. Okay, so in order to, 2 minutes?
Yeah,
okay. So in order to construct the effect in theory, this is not enough. You really need to integrate out the modes. That is, so far we've written the fields, the long distance fields in terms of the short distance fields, but these fields are still fields in the theory. And integrating out means really solving the equation of motion. So because this construction is really true realization by realization, that is, we can, in every realization, will be true that if there are some special configuration of short distance physics, it will affect the long distance physics. But it is possible to average it out. That is, we can solve the equation of motion, take the expectation value in many realizations. So this turns out to be a good approximation if you're interested in the long distance physics, because the typical correlation size of the short distance physics is about the nonlinear scale. So the regions are correlated on distance over the nonlinear scale, 10 megaparsec, and we're interested in larger distances. So in every realization, this quantity will be more or less equal to the average quantity, and with small fluctuation that we can consistently expand in the variance, for example. And so we take the expectation value of this stress energy tensor in the background on the long. So, and the results, for example, are that, for example, if you take the expectation value in the background on the long, and we say that the long is infinitely long, so that we're really looking for the background, the stress energy tensor of the short modes takes the following form. There is the energy density, which is 1 plus the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, and the pressure, which is 2 times the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And you see that the effective pressure is the sum of these two terms, which on its own is very large. Remember that this is like delta rho. This is delta times phi. Phi is 10 to minus 5, but delta is 10 to 15. So these terms, in principle, is very large. And also this term, but they come in the combination 2k plus omega, which is the combination that cancel for virialized structure. So as soon as the system becomes short distance physics, but also very non-perturbed, you can't virialized, it decouples from this expression, just the sum to zero, and the effective pressure it just decouples at zero. So this tells us that all the effect, the induced back reaction, come from the effect on the pressure on the background, which was, remember, we started with zero pressure, and now we have some pressure. All the pressure comes only from the modes, which have become nonlinear, but not already virialized. And so it saturates when this quantity delta is of order 1, and so the pressure is of order 10 to minus 5. So there is no back reaction. And then you can go on and do the effective theory of the fluctuation, which is now you take the expectation value in the background of a long, like the background field method. And you can find, I will skip it, that you find that, of course, this expectation value depends on phi long through tidal effects. And these tidal effects turn out to be proportional to the derivative of tau, to the derivative of phi. For example, you find the expectation value of the kinetic part, for example, contains the double derivative of phi long, which is just the tidal stress tensor. But by the equation of motion, this double derivative of phi is equal to the derivative of the velocity. So you see that the effective stress energy tensor take the form of the one of an imperfect fluid where there is a contribution which is the derivative of the velocity, which is really exactly what viscosity is. It's a contribution of the stress energy tensor, which is the derivative of velocity. So you find that the effect theory at long distance is the one of a fluid with viscosity. And indeed, I skipped this slide, but indeed the viscosity turned out to be very large. It's even large, it's comparable to the pressure. And you can see that this is a fluid where the usually in normal fluids, the pressure is way larger than the viscosity, which is, and then all the superviscosity, everything is hierarchically small. This fluid is the most viscous fluid that you can have, because the pressure is as small as the viscosity. So it's almost not a fluid, but it's just a fluid at largest possible viscosity. And in order to measure the coefficient of this viscosity, you have to do some matching with ultraviolet theory. Okay, I have one slide. So the matching with ultraviolet theory is done by computing the ultraviolet theory and measuring correlation functions with the correlation function, for example, with the long distance physics mode. And the idea is to be able to read off the coefficient of the long distance physics by studying correlation function of long modes. So for example, you can define a quantity like the trace of tau ij, which in the long distance physics is just proportional to the density over density and the velocity. And this you can also define in the short distance physics, and you can match. And this is something that we are doing now. For example, what you have to do now is use the V physics, which is the fluid, it's a Boltzmann equation, because the dark matter is a free streaming dark matter and the ultraviolet. We match using numerical and body simulation, the full astrophysical one. And then you measure a bunch of correlation, which allows you to extract the speed of sound. And then you apply perturbation theory. And you see that normal perturbation theory wasn't converging, but it was giving corrections, relative corrections of order 60%, order one correction perturbation theory. And we see that the correction that we are getting from putting a speed of sound or a viscosity of order 10 to minus 5, which is what we expect, is very comparable to the one perturbation theory. This is why now we hope that this perturbative theory that now we define should converge, because this one didn't converge, but now we're putting effects of the same size and the sum should converge. So this is the measurement. We're beginning to measure the speed of sound, which we're indeed defining to be of order 10 to the minus 6, 5 times over C, which is the one expected. And so the idea is that hopefully we will be able to match all the way to observation. So in this way, with this very simple cutoff, we define a perturbation theory which is convergent manifestly, because the theory contains only long wavelength fluctuations, which are small amplitude, and by measuring the coefficient of this higher dimensional operator from the embodied simulation, we'll be able to make computation effective theory and hopefully do all the way to connect to the data and be able to predict analytically the power spectrum. Okay, sorry for.
Any questions?
So, I mean, if you are doing simulations, why don't you just measure dielectric oscillation from simulations anyway?
Yeah, it's true. First of all, it's always better to have an analytic control of quantities, because you have some intuition, you understand better. For example, what we find is that people was putting this damping by hand, this stochastic noise by hand, these two, and instead here we have a physical motivation. We are seeing that the back reaction of the short distance physics on the long distance physics is to induce some viscosity, which indeed accounts for this damping. And then there are also the stochastic, the fact that we took the average and this variance accounts for the stochastic variation. Now, technically, we want to measure very well the cosmological parameters with the variable acoustic oscillations. Taking it's a big difference from measuring doing 1 gigaparsec simulation and a 100 megaparsec simulation. It's a factor of 10 to the 3 speed in the simulation. And since we want to scan over cosmological parameters, we need only very, very small, because nonlinear physics is very small. So why you should simulate all the universe to do small nonlinear physics? So the idea is that we can do very, very short, very, very rapid simulation, 10 to the 3 faster. And then, so, I mean, it's a questionable how much
people could do with simulations.
The point is that it's not just calculating one expectation value, you need all the moments of that.
Yeah, but that's one simulation. But still, it's one simulation.
No, no, it's not one simulation because you need this box, like this 100 megaparts of box. You want to see how it talks to the next 100.
No, the box is 10 megaparts. So, nonlinear scale is really 10 megaparts. And we do a 100 megaparts in box, so we have several boxes, 10 to the 6 boxes. Well, this is so far. Indeed, I agree with you. So that's why it's very important to do this calculation we're doing now. The first paper was just okay, we can do it, great. But until you show you can do it and you do it, it will have no impact. But so far we're being able to do everything and we're getting there. So we think we can do it 100 megaparts. And then you see it's a better than 3 faster. And plus you always gain the intuitive, the analytic control, the intuitive feature. For example, simulation will never have variance in. So how do you take care of variance? How much will be, that's a reducible systematic in simulation. In principle, we have these parameters and this will be fitted to the data. If you even are not able to match it, this will be fitted to the data and that will be called, that will have names. It's the speed of sound of the matter, it's the speed of sound of variance, it's the viscosity of the matter, viscosity of variance. They will have some physical meaning and these are the true parameters to be fitted to the data, not the skewness of the peak, the widening of the peak, not random parameters. What will fit to the data are the physical ones.
My concern is that this could depend on time and in wave number. These are not, I don't see why they should be constant.
They depend on time, but they depend on time. You can measure several, you can output the same simulation several times.
Yeah, but
wave number, you have to look, these are wave number independent. It's a derivative expansion, so the derivatives are in the operator. And this is you have to take the wave number independent. So these fields should become wave number independent long distances, like the speed of sound is wave number independent long distance, and you measure that coefficient. The non wave number independent.
But you have a small simulation, so you don't go to the long distance.
Well, this is question because we think that 60 megabytes.
Maybe you guys can continue the discussion in Friday. It's okay. We can go eat lunch. So we reconvene at 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
And lunch is in the first quarter.
Thank you for the attention.